Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chen Baker.
Hello.
Hi. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Each week, we come together in the melted Kinder Surprise. Lara, how do you get together? If the Kinder Surprise is melted, how do you get in it?
I realized last night I hadn't put something into that section. I had to put something in. Don't judge me.
Fair enough. Well, we messily come together in the melted Kinder Surprise that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing what Apple's News Plus service means for the journalism industry, a new empowerment campaign for illustrators, and how to bounce back from rejection. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Neha Kale. Neha is a writer, journalist, and cultural critic. She writes features, criticism, and essays about art, culture, people, and places, appearing in titles such as the Sydney Morning Herald Spectrum, the Saturday Paper, SBS Life, The Guardian, Vice, ABC, The Griffin Review, Broadsheet, and many, many more. Formerly the editor of Vault Magazine, she's now their editor at large. A little while ago, Neha joined us as a fabulous speaker at our live Open Taps event in Sydney, and we're so chuffed that the stars aligned perfectly for her to join us here in the Melbourne studio for today's show. Neha, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
We're so excited. It's really nice to cross paths with you again. I can't remember how we got in touch in the first place.
Yeah, what's the original genesis there?
I honestly have no idea. Someone, I think I was asking around for people in Sydney to do Open Taps. Someone suggested to me, hey, there's this awesome woman, Neha Kale. And I think I just sent you an email and was like, hello, you don't know me. It sort of blossomed from there. But we're all very, very happy that you're here and that you've taken some time out of your kind of Easter break to sit in the hot box with us.
My pleasure. I'm a big fan of what Jackie Winter does. So, yes, nice to be here.
We invited you here just to give us compliments. So,
What are you doing in town?
Take it. Hanging out with friends. Yeah. And looking at exhibitions and chilling out.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It's excellent.
Well, I think we'll get straight into it as we do every week. Lara, what do you got for us?
All right. So we are like about a month late discussing this, but on March 25th, Apple held their, big keynote launch event where they announced a range of things, including the launch of Apple News Plus, which is basically meant to be this kind of roided up paid subscription version. Hitting the gym.
Swole,
exactly. It's a swole version of their current Apple News service. And it has been received with mixed reviews, to say the least. But my favorite of these was posted on the Neiman Lab website. It was written by writer Joshua Benton.
What's Neiman Lab?
I don't know a lot about Neiman Lab, to be honest. Do you?
Neiman Lab, it's like a journalism industry site, which is really interesting. And they cover all different kinds of journalism, media news.
Yes, there you go. States. So glad you're here. but the piece is titled, Apple News Plus is a fine way to read magazines, but a disappointment to anyone wishing for a real boost for the news business. So it's this article that I want to use as our jumping off point today.
Excellent.
So some background for people who might not know, Apple News Plus is based off the app Texture, which is a sort of like Netflix for magazines kind of vibe, which Apple bought last year. And as the author of this piece points out, based off Texture is probably an understatement. It is pretty much Texture squeezed into the kind of Apple News interface. And Texture is great. The author, for one, is a happy paying customer. But the hopes for what Apple News Plus would offer were definitely higher for most of us, I think, myself included. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest grumbles from pretty much everyone. Jeremy, put your phone away.
I was trying to get it. I was trying to see if it was on my phone.
But yeah, no, the biggest grumble at the moment, I think, from pretty much everyone or one of, is how much Apple News Plus is really a service for magazines, not news, and not even magazine content in general. It's specifically tailored to like magazine issues. And I mean, nothing against magazines, of course, but it is supposed to be Apple News, right? Apple News Plus has over 300 magazines, but I think the chances are that the good ones you've heard of were already on Texture, which currently lists 204 magazines anyway. So in addition to all those magazines, the service does include some content from a few non-magazine publishers. So in newspapers, that's just Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times at this stage. And there are a few digital news publications as well, various verticals from New York Magazine, Vox, TechCrunch. The Skim. But that's it for now anyway. So it's been, I think, made somewhat clear that Apple doesn't consider the news side of things all that critical to the bundle. The cost for this premium service is $9.99 a month. Apple CEO Tim Cook said that to subscribe to all of these publications individually, you'd have to pay $8,000 a year. So what a deal.
What a deal.
But as the author of the article points out, and this was my favorite paragraph, I think. He said that this is mathematically true, but not many people are paying for ABC Soaps in Depth and All About Beer and Birds and Blooms and Canadian Cycling and Cottage Life and Cruising World and Deer Hunting and Diabetes Self-Management and Family Handyman and Fit Pregnancy and Baby and Gluten-Free Living and Golf Tips and Hello Canada and Midwest Living and Parents Latina and Popular Woodworking and Saltwater Sportsman and Successful Farming and The Pioneer Woman and Truck Trend and Wood and Yoga Journal to begin with. Which is a fair point. But yeah, obviously being pitched as kind of an upsell inside an app that already has like 85 million people using it every month is going to convert a lot more subscriptions than Texture ever could. But in the author's words again, there are no companies with greater capacity to do good for both the news industry and the state of news consumption than Apple and Google. They control the operating systems that we spend countless hours staring at and getting information from. When Google decides to show users more news, it works, fast and at scale. When Apple decides to make a news app, it drives a lot of news to people who wouldn't otherwise have seen it. And because Apple's customers are the most attractive for news organizations, they on average have more money and consume more news. What they do with paid content matters even more. Which I think is a great point. So this article, I do want to open this up in a moment, but the article does a really good job of highlighting a lot of the issues with Apple News, with the Plus service, particularly with regard to the actual UX. For example, how hard it is to actually find any news content because the whole thing is so optimized for magazines. And even within that, there seem to be a lot of problems with the consistency or kind of lack thereof of the layouts and the sort of lack of standardization across publications, making it really difficult to know what you're getting into when you download an issue of a magazine that you're not totally familiar with. And there's like the sort of density in the interface that makes reading and maneuvering from an issue is like table of contents to the article to the publication itself, like a total pain in the ass. And also kind of seems to center on the fact that Texture was born in a kind of uniquely hopeful but dumb moment for the news industry. That sort of short window of time, circa 2009, 2011, when people truly thought that the iPad was going to change everything.
Totally.
Back then, you know, tablets, not phones, were kind of the focus. You know, that's what publishers were looking at, and it didn't exactly pan out that way. The writer points to this 2010 documentary, Page One, inside the New York Times, where there was an entire section focused on the iPad as journalism savior, with like smartphones receiving like barely a passing mention. And they thought it would sort of be this do-over of the first round of mobile disruption, and publishers poured a lot of money into it. But tablets have never risen much above 7 or 8% of all US web traffic. Meanwhile, you know, phones, of course, generate the majority of all web traffic and, you know, most American European news sites. And then you've got this sort of weird and unhelpful hangover from that period where like many of the magazines on Apple News Plus are just like really not optimized for phone viewing, despite Apple insisting that that was like the point here. And then I guess like you've got some who are using ANF, like the Apple News format that allows for kind of more readability and all kinds of flashy tricks. But so many are using this really clunky PDF style viewing where to read anything, you have to like manually zoom in and scroll. And I don't know, it's not really clear if this is an issue with Apple's tools that make it just like very cumbersome, or if there's a lack of resources and investment on the kind of publishing end. But the whole service really seems completely stuck in this old like issue model. And Apple does very little to help readers kind of actually navigate the massive mountain of magazines they now have access to. And for news content, the whole experience is just even worse. And it's really unclear how the stories you see were picked or whether you're even getting the most up-to-date news. And some of the pieces like hours or even like sometimes days old, which for news, like magazines, whatever, but for news, it's like not ideal, right? So granted, like none of these design issues are enough to kind of sink the service. The UX can and probably will be fixed. They're mostly just kind of strange inconsistencies that, you know, yes, annoying. They really probably speak more to Apple's like scattershot partnership approach that's like yielding different levels of attention to detail and investment from the participating outlets. But I imagine over time there will be kind of more standardization and these things will be ironed out. But the biggest concern for me and what I really want to focus on with you guys today, particularly with you, Neha, is the potential impact of a service like this on the media industry as a whole and how it's funded. Texture, the original app, was built by a consortium of magazine companies, Condé Nast, Hearst, Meredith, Time Inc., as a way for those magazine giants to control the means of distribution for their product and not let a tech giant like Apple take charge of it. And then, of course, they sold it to Apple, which I think is a sign of just how badly the industry needed the money. But whether it's the right decision in the long term, I'm really not sold. And I have a lot to say on this area, but I want to turn to you, Neha, first and get a bit of an inside view, because as a journalist and, as you said, the editor at large of Vault and the former editor, how do you feel about the launch of something like Apple News Plus? Do you think it's a good thing, a bad thing for journalists and publications? How does it kind of affect your bottom line and the way you do business, both for like for a publication like Vault, but also personally as a freelancer.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's kind of like the notion of Netflix for magazines. Like, I think it's a really interesting way of describing it, right? Because it's sort of the great thing about something like Netflix is that there's more content being produced than ever before, but there's also this massive income destruction for creators.
Yes.
And, you know, magazines take so much time to produce and they are such a labor of love, but also they speak to a certain audience. And it's kind of like the fact that to be able to give away that content for a largely kind of like discounted rate, it actually undermines what a magazine is all about. And I also kind of think that, like, sort of stepping away from that, subscriptions like this, like, it sounds amazing on paper, but the magazine experience is something that is very specific to kind of, you know, like a print experience. So you buy a magazine because you're invested in the experience of sitting down with something in a kind of closed loop and having this kind of one-on-one relationship with the thing. And that's not to say that, you know, online is hugely important, but I think that whenever these kinds of services like Texture and Apple News and even different tablet kind of subscriptions, it kind of takes away the whole joy of being with a magazine. And then the back end of that is editors and writers put so much into actually creating that for a reader. Like when I was editing, I was always thinking about myself as a reader and how I feel when I'm opening up a magazine and the element of surprise and the element of being swept away by something or being inspired by something and creating that tactility it's actually like an art form that doesn't really, I feel like it doesn't really translate. It doesn't translate. And that's not to say that it's not good to have these, but I just think that it kind of, I don't want to say cheapens what producing a magazine is, but in some senses it does.
Yeah. Do you think like publications like Vault or others have a choice now, like whether they join Apple in this or are they kind of just forced to, like if you want to stay in the game, you have to kind of be part of these services?
I think there's always a choice. Yeah. It's been such a boom in independent magazines in the last 15 years. And the ones that I've seen that are really successful are the ones that stay true to what they're about.
Completely.
That's not to say that's not a place for kind of more kind of mass market magazines to be on something like that. But then it's also when it comes to converting to subscription, like I'm not convinced that that actually happens.
Yeah.
You know, like it's tricky.
The whole subscription thing is really hard because like, I think the biggest question here around all of this is like, well, there's kind of the question of how it affects people's desire to pay for the other digital news subscriptions. But that was already a bit of a broken model. Like, it's like huge success for a few, weak results for many.
Yep.
You've got like the Times, the Post, Wall Street Journal.
Yep.
You know, they've built these like hugely successful digital subscriber bases in like the millions. But then all the kind of smaller papers or magazines or whatever, like struggling to kind of achieve anything close to that. But now the question as well is like, to what degree most people can be convinced to get more than one digital news subscription? Like if you've got Apple News Plus, this kind of veritable all you can eat buffet of all the major publications, like why would you pay for anything else? And out of that $9.99 a month subscription fee, there's like this very small share of money that makes its way back to each publication that actually supports the production of like daily news or like watchdog journalism or investigative reporting or anything. You know, it's like, it's crazy. And Apple takes a pretty hefty cut. It's 50%.
That's huge.
It's huge.
Yeah,
exactly. And then the rest is distributed to publishers based on their share of readers' attention. Mm-hmm. There was a pretty scathing TechCrunch article I was reading, which mind you, part of TechCrunch is part of the Apple News Plus bundle. They said publishers were crazy to jump into bed with Apple News Plus, effectively rendering their own subscription options pointless in exchange for a sliver of the $10 per month payout.
Absolutely.
Which I think is fair. But yeah, look, I think Apple News Plus definitely threatens to open up a pretty big hole in news site paywalls, allowing their kind of best premium articles to escape. And I think publishers are hoping that they're going to get exposure to new audiences, but why would any potential new or existing direct subscribers to a publisher be willing to pay that kind of more healthy monthly fee to access the top content, but also supports the kind of whole newsroom when they can just cherry pick what they want via Apple News Plus, and Apple will shave off a few cents for the publisher while owning all the data, the customer relationship, all the power. As that TechCrunch article put it, why subscribe to that publisher? I already pay for Apple News Plus should be the question haunting journalists' nightmares. So yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing is pretty intense, right? But there was a key thing that came up in our chat a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about, I think with Jess Cruikshank, we're talking about publishing and Amazon and how that's changing the relationship between publisher and reader. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely applies here too, which is this kind of idea that like to succeed, publishers need attention, they need data, they need revenue, and Apple News Plus gets in the way of all of those things because readers are getting content through the Apple interface and not the outlet site.
Completely.
And then, you know, so all the other money-making content where they would normally sort of highlight it, they're not getting. Publishers no longer get readers' email addresses for follow-up marketing, cookies for ad targeting, content personalization, or their credit card info to kind of speed up purchases. And so to save themselves, publications have had to kind of get into bed with everybody else. And at the bottom of each article, you even got, you know, like News Plus recommends posts by their competitor, like an outlet's competitors. And readers don't develop a connection to the publication itself. They develop a connection to Apple. And I find that it's the same because like when I even just use it, just the regular free Apple News, I actually often don't notice where I'm reading a piece from. I'm just reading it. And it's like, that's a weird, scary thing. And I don't like that. I don't like that about the way that I'm consuming it. I think like just like when Facebook totally toppled the news system for a while, like publishers are being thrown into this kind of coliseum of attention. And that's where kind of clickbait and fake news reign supreme because you're at total mercy of the algorithm. And which outlets actually earn money will really largely be determined by what Apple decides to show in those first few kind of curatorial shots.
Totally.
And it's just so much power to give to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just, it's also about platforms, right? Because I think publishers, to be able to control your own platform as a publisher is everything. And that's about your audience. And to be able to kind of reader loyalty is a huge thing as well.
Oh, yeah.
And that is what magazines depend on, you know, loyal readers and a loyal audience. And that loyalty enables you
to destroy that relationship.
Yeah, that connection between the reader and a publication is absolutely everything. That's what writers work towards. That's what editors work towards. And once you ruin that, or once you compromise that, it sort of changes.
And that's it, right? It's like, is there any going back now, though? That's what's so scary.
Well, how is it different to anything that's happening in music?
Well,
It's really similar.
Like Spotify. Like it's
completely. Yeah. And I don't know. I think absolutely. Like you kind of, we talk about the iTunes era, like musicians were earning kind of solid revenue. You would go, you would buy an album for like $20 or whatever because you like one song, and that was just the way it is.
Yeah.
And then you happen to listen to the rest, you like the rest, you become a fan, you buy tickets, you buy merch, whatever it is. And then iTunes came along and you can just buy a single for 99 cents and you form this bond with Apple instead of with the artist. They talk about this in the article.
But it seems like, all the artists, you know, they're making their money from either Patreon or from touring or from merch. It's like, you know, what's the...
I don't think they've fallen out of that depression. Yeah. Like the music industry is still in a massive state of flux, and there's been a huge shift with the way that artists... Well, I guess don't earn money in the way that they used to. Like it's a problem. It's not a fixed problem.
Well, if this goes in the same direction, then where does that leave kind of journalism?
Well, exactly. That's the problem.
And the similar things are happening with patrons, but I feel like this, it's kind of not sustainable, and it's kind of, it's about distribution has changed so radically that, you know, it's not sustainable. But I just want to advocate for the fact that, you know, the premium stories in Apple News Plus, like a premium story. So just say like long form features, things that have actually like changed the culture, like that, you know, the Me Too story, things like that, that, you know, investigations that take years to put together. Those are massively important, and they actually have a massive effect on the culture. And if those things are not paid for, like, we are all worse off as a society.
I completely agree. The other thing the article touches on, which we won't go into too deeply, but just how this really affects local news and without having local news to kind of keep your local area like accountable.
Yeah.
That's actually a really dangerous thing. And
so
journalists,
dangerous.
Like, I mean, there's lots to say for very fun feature sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That's wonderful and important, all the entertainment work. But there's also the other side where journalism plays a vital role in ensuring, well, hopefully keeping sort of certain things in check. And yeah, it's kind of scary to think we're handing in all of the power over to something like Apple. I think the one last thing I wanted to kind of point out was this, well, two very last things. So I wanted to talk about Facebook, basically. Like the TechCrunch article that I was reading, it highlighted that like at any time Apple can decide it wants more visual photo-based content or less serious world news or suddenly preference shorter takes or whatever. And what if Apple signs up a kind of publisher's biggest competitor and sends them all the attention? We already kind of saw all of this with Facebook. They wanted to build the world's like personalized newspaper and delivered tons of referral traffic. And then abruptly they decided to favor friends and family content.
Absolutely.
And they left publishers completely to starve. And here we see publishers giving Apple the exact same iron grip over their businesses. And, you know, you've got like the Wall Street Journal just hired a ton of talent just to make content for this. And then if Apple changed strategy, like what happens to those people? It just sounds like really precarious to be in one of those jobs right now.
It's very, very risky.
It's very, very risky. It's just,
yeah. And also allowing tech companies to set the agenda when it should be publishers and editors setting the agenda is really terrifying.
Completely. And I guess there's this whole idea of the kind of like good enough theory, which like years ago, TechCrunch published this article about Instagram, like totally decimating Snapchat when they released the stories feature. And when it first launched, like it lacked a ton of Snapchat's features, but it was good enough. And it was conveniently located where people already were in Instagram. And so like Snapchat didn't lose all its existing users or anything, but why would new users sign up? Like the growth totally plummeted. And it's kind of the same here. Like Apple News Plus is preloaded on your device. If you have an iPhone, we already have a card set up. It's bundled with lots of other content. And even if it doesn't offer this kind of like unlimited permanent access to every story, it's good enough.
Yeah.
And then every time a new outlet partners with them, good enough gets even better. And so I end up at this question that I totally struggle to answer because I'm caught between wanting to advocate for the arts, journalism included, and also being someone with not a lot of money in their bank account who wants cool shit for as small a fee as possible. And I just keep coming back to like, if Apple News Plus is a bad solution, what's better? And what is the ideal situation for how we get our media and how publishers create it? And I just don't know how to answer that. And I really wish we could talk about this for like another hour, but Jeremy's giving me the hurry the fuck up face. So I think we're going to have to leave it at that.
It's fine for me. I listen to the podcast really quick, but you know, for everyone else, I'm not sure how much they want to go.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please email us at podcast@jackiewinter.com and tell Jeremy off for cutting us off.
Yeah, look, some really good things in here. And I think, yeah, it's opening questions that every kind of creative is having to grapple with at the moment. I think in a lot of ways, you know, Apple Plus is inevitable. Like, you know, it was always kind of going to happen. And so now we need to figure out, you know, how we kind of work within that. So pieces like this are a great way to kind of start thinking about that and having that conversation. Awesome. We will move on from there. My link of the week comes from the AOI, which is the Association of Illustrators based out of the UK. And I think it's probably safe to say that without the AOI, that Jackie Winter might not exist. Now, when we formed in 2006, the AOI was one of the only fully staffed professional societies for illustrators. And I would say probably remains one of the few in operation today. I mean, there's lots of different ones for illustrators, but in terms of the resources that they have, they're one of the few. And I knew it was important that when we start the agency, you know, the biggest thing was we needed to get the best artists. And I needed to make sure that our terms were kind of ironclad and artist friendly. And I was just coming from nowhere. So I wanted to make sure that we were operating under best practices. So I worked with the AOI at the time to vet our terms and conditions from our quotes and all of our kind of other paperwork to our artist agreements and making sure this was the case. Now, in the years since, I've really been a passionate advocate and member of the AOI. Jackie Winter as a whole has been. And while they've always been incredibly active for all that they do in the illustration community, not just in the UK, but really in the world, they've recently launched this kind of campaign, which is the culmination of decades of the good work that they have done. So I'm really excited to share it here today. Now, the campaign itself lives under the hashtag not a hobby, so hashtag not a hobby. And while I know this may seem specific to illustrators and illustration, there's some really universal issues covered that I think are worth looking at for even freelance creatives or not just illustrators as well. So in the introductory page, they introduce their goal, and I quote here, "Illustration is a major contributor to the cultural economy. Brands, businesses, and individuals recognize its value to sell products and ideas and engage their audience. It is one of the fastest growing undergraduate courses. The success of the illustration business is undeniable. But the business of illustration, day-to-day negotiation, business planning, cash flow, marketing is too often overlooked by illustrators. Now, this campaign addresses that. It's time for an overhaul. It's time to invest in our skills, our businesses, and ourselves. It's time for a revolution." Very strong words there. And I think, this covers a lot of topics that we've come back to over and over on the show, especially as a freelancer. You have to kind of deal, like, you know, you have to master all the different kind of parts of your practice as if you were a larger business. And also even tying into what we were talking about before with journalism, it's like, I think illustration has in some ways been buffered or kind of kept safe from a lot of aspects of technology that have kind of been really challenging to deal with, like for writers and photographers kind of especially, you know, these kind of systems or even kind of artists. And it's a huge challenge. So I kind of think this is outlining some good preventative measures that, you know, can be kind of looked at. It's things that really kind of need to be thought about. So, you know, part of all this is a response to a big update that the AOI has done with how they previously had a pricing hotline, which had to be retired because of potential legal issues. But in short, the campaign is a shoring up of all their kind of business related services, one of which is their new pricing calculator, which we actually helped consult on in a small way. While the aims are revolutionary on the surface and in the tone, the actual content is mostly things that have already been developed over many years, much of which have recently been updated. So from their consultation services, where you can kind of go to them and they can kind of consult you kind of on a project or just kind of give you kind of general, more one-to-one advice, and their business writing series to their mental health resources and code of conduct. This is a great illustration of what professionals see what I did. Sorry.
You're fired.
It's a great illustration of what professional societies should do when they're at their best. So I'm more than happy to use this platform of our podcast and our social media to help get the word out.
I'm so disappointed in you.
Look, even if you are an illustrator, having the back of a group larger than yourself is incredibly empowering, but also just good business. So on top of all this, we're finally ready to reveal our own contribution to the creative industry, an online campaign of our own called Use It or Lose It, which is finally going to be probably have been launched by the time you hear this. And a lot of we'll see. Yeah. But a lot of it has been directly inspired by the AOI. So the topics here are really kind of front of mind for me. Mm-hmm. And I know you as well, Laura.
Yes.
So again, I'm keen to open this up here and hear from the two of you of kind of which of the many resources gathered here resonated with you the most. But I'll start with myself. And for me, the code of conduct is a really standout piece. Again, it's nothing new or mind-blowing, but it's something that I don't think a lot of people think about in creative work. We all know that when we kind of see a doctor that they've taken a Hippocratic oath to uphold certain standards. And I know illustrators aren't saving lives exactly, but I think it's really important to have an ethical framework set in place to kind of set the motivation and tone
no matter what work, for your practice.
Absolutely. So I think it trickles down to everything else you do as an artist. And this piece itself is a really simple page that outlines kind of 10 points all in plain English, starting with fair payment and not working on spec to handling amends and just kind of common sense confidentiality clauses. And it's not long. It's very, very short. And I think so many people can get lost in huge legalistic contracts. And I think there's always this trend for, especially people in creative fields, to just kind of ignore that stuff and try to put it in a box until it kind of comes up. And this is just a little nice thing that every AOI member can formally kind of get behind. And therefore, when and if conflicts arise, they can always defer to this code as a point in negotiation and hopefully depersonalize a fraught situation to get a positive resolution. Print it out. Put it on your estimates. I mean, we have the AOI logo proudly displayed on all of our paperwork on our website. Anyway, I don't want to go over everything point by point here, but if you're an illustrator and you're not an AOI member, you should be. If you're something else, find your professional society and join as well. Remember, too, that most organizations are not geographically restricted. Just because the AOI is in the UK and primarily operates there, it doesn't mean you can't be a member if you're here in Australia or in the States, and it doesn't exclude you from joining other professional societies like Illustrators Australia or the AIGA, all of which do very relevant work. So look, to that end, I'm really curious to hear from you, Neha, as a professional writer. What's the closest thing to the AOI that you have as a writer? And has it been part of your practice in any way?
Yeah. So we've got the MEAA, which is the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance, which it's sort of more about the code of conduct, the ethical journalist code of conduct. But also I joined up maybe a couple of years ago just because even in terms of payments and, you know, missed payments from publishers and that kind of a thing, they can advocate on your behalf. But we don't have something like the AOI. And what really interests me about that is the notion of not a hobby. And in writing, this is a really, really kind of endemic problem that we're not, similar to illustration, I guess, we're not told to take what we do seriously and our creative work seriously. And there's the expectation of writing for free and all of those kinds of things. And, you know, when you get to a certain level, you don't have to, but people will always still ask. And it could really undercuts the market for everyone. And, you know, to be able to earn a sustainable living as a writer, to earn like a decent, like middle-class wage, to have a normal life, you need to learn these skills. And, you know, I've been a full-time freelancer for 7 years and freelancing for 10 years. And I had to kind of learn all of that stuff back retroactively rather than that's the sort of thing is no one. So magazine publishers pay on publication. And that's a huge, huge problem. Because you're sometimes waiting months and months for payment. And that's a hangover from the days of the golden age of journalism when, you know, Joe and Didion would get paid like thousands of dollars for a piece once the advertising came in. And it doesn't really
fit. Waiting 6 months for $500 is not the same.
Yeah. Not quite the same. And so, you know, all of these kinds of really common sense business skills, you really have to learn and you have to push. And there's no one really advocating on our behalf from a commercial point of view.
Interesting. Anywhere?
No.
How did you learn?
Through trial and error, massive trial and error, and actually overworking a lot and burning myself out in the early days. I just moved up to Sydney when I went full-time freelance and didn't know anyone. I just worked around the clock and burnt myself out. And, you know, you kind of, and I think it's common with a lot of creative professions where you realize it by realizing you're like, this, I'm not living a life that's sustainable. And then, you know, learning how to balance different income streams and like all of that sort of a thing.
Do you find when we had Ben Law on the show, he kind of referred to kind of, I guess, more informal kind of networks of people that kind of, especially like, you know, over Twitter and how people kind of share information that way. Have you found that to be?
Absolutely. I'm really lucky that I have a lot of friends who are freelance writers who do what I do. And there's been a lot of movement towards transparency in the last few years, which is really wonderful. But at the same time, it's also kind of difficult because when you're starting out and you don't have those networks, it's much more difficult. And also per piece rate. So that's become the norm in journalism. Like I, luckily enough, get paid a lot per word, but it's taken me a long time to get paid per word. And that makes, you know, it's not ideal, but it still makes all the difference in terms of being able to make a decent living and being able to, you know, spending a week on a piece that's going to make you $200.
Yeah, gosh.
Which is,
well,
that's what it's like. I mean, we were talking about, I posted a link to a few links to, in our Slack channels the other day, I can't remember the names, the like writing databases, like who pays writers and all those sort
of things. It's crazy that even needs
it's
to exist.
So,
it does.
But there's heaps.
It
there's ones for photographers as well. There's ones for illustrators, like where people kind of anonymously write like what a publication has paid for what kind of article, blah, blah. And the databases are really useful. And it's interesting to see writers coming together like that, but also it's so depressing. Yep. Like, because I still do some freelance writing on the side as well. And like, for me, I'm lucky because I work full time.
Yep.
I don't really, it's more like I'll take a piece because I want to do it. Mm. But the budgets are so sad. Like, it's depressing what some people are making. But also, Hillary Simmons, who used to work with us, do some stuff for us here, I'm pretty sure she started it. She started a Facebook group called Freelance Writers Support Group that is quite good, which is like, the whole idea is, yeah, making this kind of closed group where people can discuss pay rates, industry practices, difficult clients, and kind of work through problems together.
It's so important. There's been a campaign actually in the UK, which I'm really interested in, by a freelance journalist called Anna Codriarado, and it's about fair pay for freelancers. And they're lobbying a lot of UK publications to start paying freelance writers when they file rather than when these publishers, and half up front, and to just have more transparency around that, because the way in which the industry is today is completely out of sync with when all these rules first came into play decades ago.
Oh yeah, and they have no relevance now. But yeah, it's like, it's the same thing with rates for illustrators. You know, nothing has kind of changed since that kind of golden age, but everything else that kind of increases every year. So it's like, things need to, you know, pace themselves out. That's why I think, you know, negotiation is a really important skill. And that was actually one of my other favorite parts of the campaign. They have a whole series there on negotiation. So there's a bunch of articles and interviews that specifically look into negotiation skills and tactics. And I'm just kind of wondering, did you have a chance to go through that? Did any of them kind of resonate with you as a freelancer? Are there any tactics that writers do that, or kind of undertake that illustrators could learn from? Or is it all universal?
Well, I think it's pretty universal. But what I really got from that is, I guess, knowing the value of your work and having the confidence in your own skill set. And I think a lot of writers tend to be strange creatures where we have like chronic self-doubt, but actually being confident.
Illustrators as well.
But being confident in your own ability and actually just asking for more as a practice. And even though, you know, sometimes magazines don't have the budget, but you need to ask and you need to set that precedent.
Mm.
And the worst that you can say is no. When writers used to ask me for more money, I couldn't necessarily offer them more money, but I always appreciated them asking. And, you know, editors should be advocating for writers. At least good editors should.
I think also learning that, exactly, saying like asking, there's no harm in asking, where like a lot of the time there really is no harm in asking.
There
like
isn't.
Things are negotiable, and that's money and contracts like, as well, and timelines and whatever. And if it's not, and you've phrased it sort of the right way, and they're a good editor or good whoever it is you're talking to, art buyer, whatever, they won't shut it off because you've requested something, you tried to negotiate. They would just say like, no, it's not possible, but here's what we can offer, you know? And so there's no, to getting comfortable with pushing the limits of what someone's put in front of you, what someone's proposed, is like such a vital skill.
Mm-hmm. I have two things that I find really useful. It's like a baseline rate of what I will work for. Mm-hmm. I have my ideal rate that I try to work for, and a baseline rate. And I also kind of roughly know what my day rate is and how much, that's how long it'll actually take me to work on an article. A big freelance feature, you know, can take up to a week of work. And when you work out the day rate for that, you have to be able to pay yourself and
completely
think about profit. I mean, that's something I'm only just thinking about, but it's just, you know, you don't want to just be able to pay your bills. You want to be able to create a sustainable practice
exactly
for the future.
Laura, let's talk about this a bit more. I mean, you've been working very closely on our own campaign here that I mentioned before, Use It or Lose It. You're deeply familiar with the issues illustrators face in running their business.
Sure.
So look, this campaign is thorough. It's not exhaustive. For example, I actually think more language around licensing/work for hire should be in the code of conduct. And that's another reason I love being part of the AOI, because I have a direct line to the kind of the people who do these things. So I think, not just kind of individuals, but businesses should be members as well, because that opens
Hell
up the
yes.
lines for those things to be done. But look, are there any resources or topics that you think haven't been covered here, which would be good for other artists to consider?
Yeah, honestly, I think the hardest thing is that there are so many resources telling freelancers that they should price for usage, that they should negotiate better terms, that they should turn down spec work, whatever else it might be, but not actually addressing how to do that. And I think knowing that you should do something and knowing how to do something is quite different. And
absolutely.
Sadly, like, pricing and negotiating terms is one of the areas that it's incredibly hard to find clear, actionable information on. And that's because it is really bloody hard to
it's
teach.
It's so hard. And you know,
it's really hard because it's so individual.
So individual. And you know, the point that I also want to bring up as well is like, in freelance writing, you have to kind of advocate for your work and negotiate for your worth all the time. And I find the more I do it, the easier I get at it. But it's also, there's all kinds of penalties. There's been studies when women negotiate, you know, for freelancing and in workplaces, that we're penalized for it. And it's because you're kind of deviating from that.
Completely.
And it, you know, these are all systemic issues, but they need to be addressed and talked about.
Oh, yeah. And I think, like, because each situation is so individual, giving broad, sweeping advice can sometimes do a bit more harm than good. And I've talked about this on the show before, and I'm a stickler for context, but like, I guess that said, how does that kind of actually help the freelancer that just wants to know exactly like, what do I charge? What language do I use to get over the line? You know? And I think the pricing calculator that the AOI have put together is a fabulous resource, a much needed one at that, that's going to bring a lot of relief to a lot of people, but it is still just a start. And like playing around with it, I came across results that I felt were accurate and also some that I felt were like not quite right. Mm-hmm. And then that makes me feel a little uneasy because I'm like, well, I can recognize that that's not quite right, but someone else will just take that and run with it. Mm-hmm. And this is why I kind of hate ever just giving a flat answer of like, this is how much X should cost. This is how you should do X, because it is so different every situation. And I'm always worried about putting on the record like an definitive answer and people running with that and it sort of completely backfiring. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, using these things as a general guide is fantastic. But in the end, there are kind of softer skills that need to be developed so that you can get a true feel for each project and client and negotiate on their specific framework to find the right balance. And it's a skill I've spent 5 years honing and yet will still never have quite right because it's impossible to get it right in every single situation. Yeah. But I think really to get better at this stuff, it's not about finding out hard information on what to price, but about tapping into those kind of communication negotiation skills. And you can do that through, you know, courses, books, real life experience, mentors, various other ways. And that's where I'd kind of be focusing my time if I was unsure. But yeah, I think, you know, like we ourselves at Jackie Winder have had to refrain from giving this very kind of specific advice on a large scale, but yet we're able to set up a service like Corvid where we can talk on an individual level one-on-one about that person's specific situation and give advice based on that. But it's kind of impossible to say in a single article or website like that your illustration should cost X amount and these are the terms you should have in place because it's just so like vastly different for every situation, every artist, every client, every project. And I think what is more doable though, and what I'd love to see more of from both us and from the AOI, is to help give people the language surrounding it so that they can have these conversations with clients and over time themselves develop the pricing processes that work for them. So I think setting a few like absolute like no-nos like the AOI have done is a really great start. Mm-hmm. But in terms of becoming more literate, I think it definitely requires some specialized training or consulting. So as you said, Jeremy, like becoming an AOI member gives you access to their team with consultations so they can help you with these things, or engaging us with Corvid gets you like consultations on these specific aspects. And I know that's like tooting our own horn, but that's literally why we set this stuff up is because of these issues. And then that advice is kind of tailored to you, to your practice, to your clients. And I think none of this should take away from the unbelievable resources that are provided by the AOI. They do an awesomely incredible job of providing so much information about things that are notoriously hard to explain concisely. And I really don't think you would ever regret the money it costs for membership if you're an illustrator, because there's some invaluable stuff there. But I think about when you ask this question, like I think about how did I learn this stuff, right? Like if I could be taught, if we all here could be taught, surely you can teach it to other people, right?
Absolutely.
But I spent 5 years just like waist deep in coding, negotiating, contract discussions, et cetera, learning from you, Jeremy, from the rest of the team here, fucking things up, making mistakes, and basically just doing it over and over and over thousands of times until I get to a point where I feel like I do have a very solid grasp on the industry. Yeah. But I don't think any article or short course could have given me that. And that doesn't mean that these resources aren't very important and can't, you know, shorten some of those steps. Yeah. But all I'm saying is that they're a start and a really invaluable one. But anyone looking for some sort of magic answer isn't going to find it because it doesn't exist.
No.
You can kind of only really start to build the general skills and arm yourself with the industry lingo and knowledge, some key do's and don'ts, and then kind of experiment for yourself until you get it right.
I think for me, it comes down to that hashtag not a hobby thing again, where it's like so many creative people are conditioned to think about their work as being somehow peripheral to society or as not, you know, as not being labor when it is labor.
Absolutely.
And the relationship with money is really, really important.
Yes.
Most of us start, you know, creative fields because we have this passion and love for what we do, but we hone these skills and we hone our talents to a point where we can monetize it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, it's just a bit dangerous when you stop thinking about what that actually means. And it's about quality of life as well. What kind of quality of life do you want to be living if you're not getting paid fairly about your work? And I'm very passionate about that. Like,
yes, completely. And for a lot of artists, that's why I think that's why, you know, agents exist at all, is because it is a really hard thing to do for yourself.
Yeah.
A, because it's just like actually difficult sort of emotionally, skillfully, but also it takes a lot of time and a lot of knowledge. And so that's why agents are there to do that for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm much more comfortable being on this side doing it for other people than I am doing it for myself.
Awesome. Well, look, if you are a writer, photographer, or anything else out there and you belong to a professional society, I'd love to hear more about it because, we're with Use It or Lose It. We have a whole kind of resources page dedicated to talking about these issues and putting them out there to make sure that they're...
And we'll tell you guys more about Use It or Lose It next week, yes, we promise.
Yes, indeed, we will. Thank you very much for your thoughts here. We'll move on to our last link from here. Our last link of the week, as always, comes from our special guest. Neha, before you talk about what you've brought to the table, I'm a bit more curious to hear about everyone's internet hygiene. Kind of where do you find your links? Are you a Twitter person, RSS, and where did you get this one?
I'm Twitter, but also newsletters. Mm. I love newsletters.
Hearing a lot of them. Which are your favorites?
I love Austin Kleon's newsletter.
Oh, yeah,
it's wonderful.
Good.
And Anne Friedman's newsletter are my two favorite.
Oh, I don't read hers.
Anne Friedman's a really wonderful freelance journalist in America, but she has a weekly newsletter that's incredible. Mm. But this one I just kind of...
I don't need more newsletters. Don't tell me this. Far out. I already do no work, so...
But I'm also just a compulsive internet deep dive browser and constantly have millions of tabs open. And
oh my God, you are at home here. You should see Jeremy's computer. It is, well, mine too, but he's another level.
I feel like I'm the
You've
same. Like
never seen anything like
million
Jeremy's.
Million tabs. But I don't know. I just kind of, newsletters mostly, but then deep dives and then one thing leads to the other thing. And
oh yeah.
Rabbit holes.
I know the feeling.
And tell me a bit more about this link that you picked.
Okay, so this link, this was in the New York Times Smarter Living column, which is an interesting column, which has all kinds of like life advice. And it was how to bounce back from rejection, which I think is a super interesting topic. I'm like, lately I'm more sort of interested in learning about rejection and failure than
people feeling rejected.
Like, no, I mean, I feel like as a writer, your life is always like, you know, highs and lows. It's always like, this is great, this is crap. Like that's just what it is. But I think it's really interesting, the notion of rejection, especially in our kind of cultural moment where we have this like need to kind of always have our sort of best foot forward and always kind of, especially if you're like a freelancer, you have to kind of show yourself as being super successful all the time. But I kind of think that I'm always more interested to see, you know, how people deal with failure. And so this particular link talks about, I guess, about how rejection is really inevitable, but bouncing back from rejection and, you know, how actually when you get rejected for something, it could be because of a lack of fit in the relationship, but also that we're all composed of multiple selves, like our professional self, our creative self, our out of work self. And it's almost an opportunity to reframe and kind of invest in another part of yourself rather than putting all your eggs in one basket. And I just found that was a really interesting kind of approach to it.
Rejection isn't a rejection of the entirety of you.
Yes,
but that
exactly.
One little part of you, that thing didn't work.
Totally.
And for whatever reason.
Yeah. And as writers, you know, we're kind of, sometimes we feel like we're just our bylines where we put all of our self-worth into what we do. You know, I certainly do.
And I think that goes for a lot of professions though. Like people are really attached to their work and workers' identity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I kind of, as I've been working longer and longer, I'm more interested in kind of challenging that a little bit and kind of thinking about it in the same way, you know, I can be passionate about my work, but maybe it's unhealthy to think about this as being my entire self.
Maybe. I think we're all learning that,
but learning it very, very slowly. So I guess I was just really interested in you know, the notion of bouncing back from rejection, how rejection can kind of help you understand yourself better and get better at what you do as well and build resilience.
It's interesting, I think, because like as producers and agents, like we face rejection all the time.
That's why I get you guys to do it.
Exactly. You hate confrontation of any sort, Jeremy. But you know, projects that don't go ahead because of budget or style or timings or some other reason we never even get to find out because they just never applied to us.
Yeah.
You know? And it can be hard. Like, I think it's also easier for us sometimes, like I was saying with the last link, like because we're somewhat removed, like they're not rejecting us personally, they're rejecting the artist or the company, you know, but it can also be harmful to think like that because we are the first touch point for a client, you know, and we're a big part of whether a project gets approval or not. And so as salespeople and as service providers, you do have to have some awareness of the fact that maybe it is you and maybe you could be doing something differently, you know, to get better results. And I think the hardest thing about rejection in any situation is knowing like, this is the thing that gets me. It's like knowing when it was because it was like just not the right time or relationship fit.
Yeah.
But it was a good idea, whatever. Or when it was just like a bad idea to begin
Absolutely.
With. Absolutely. You know, and how to discern between those things.
It's a real skill.
Because there's kind of the like never give up, you know, always you fight for your dream, blah, blah. And then there's also the like, no, walk away before you like fall off the cliff.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And like, how do you know when to keep going with something and try again or like when to pivot to something else? And I think perhaps maybe the best thing about being rejected a lot, at least let's say specifically in the work that we do. Perhaps that it kind of helps to hone that sense of intuition that helps you to know what works, what doesn't,
absolutely,
and why. And maybe that's the same with writing, like being rejected a lot helps you to figure out, I don't know, what works and what doesn't. But like, yeah, I think overall there's like a lot to be said for separating the personal from the professional.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't mean you don't use professional rejection to improve your personal self, because you should, you may as well, but rather you don't like let it define who you are entirely. And I think that comes with time and experience. And there is a fine line, I think, between brushing off rejection in a healthy way and also just not learning from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's tricky.
And, you know, I'm really interested in this notion of, so in this article, they talk about the fact that that they did studies and the actual physical reaction to rejection is like physical pain, which I find, I was like, that makes so much sense.
Yeah,
right?
Completely.
But at the same time, it's kind of like, if you know how to take care of yourself, like self-care, like how do you look after yourself? And how do you realize that like this is just part of it? It's part of putting yourself out there. And freelance writers get rejected constantly.
I know.
That is part of what it is. And actually I've gotten rejected from editors like 12 years ago that I work with now.
Yeah.
And it's a process and it's a conversation. And it's about reframing it like that.
Oh, God. Jeremy, like, this whole, like, the pain link, what do you think about that?
The pain link is super interesting. And I mean, I think as a parent as well, like, you know, I think a lot now about kind of, how things that happen very kind of early on set you up for kind of certain success or failure in other ways in terms of, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together, or wire together, fire together, you know.
Yeah.
And I definitely kind of can see how rejection can set off a psychological process that, you know, if it keeps happening, is going to get some kind of negative
result. No matter how good a parent you are, you're going to mess up your kids in some way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I kind of think about, for me personally, I know that like I mentioned like this in the podcast before about like getting rejected for all these kind of like busboying jobs and dishwashing jobs in Melbourne, like when I first came. Like,
no.
Because like, you know, when I first
came. I can't imagine pre like family, Jeremy. It's so weird to me.
I will never forget being rejected for a job at, what was it called on Swanton Street? The upstairs, downstairs place. Lounge. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. And you know.
You wanted to work at Lounge?
I didn't. No, I just needed a job, you know, and I was rejected for a lot of them. And a lot, you know, funnily enough, I couldn't remember the name, but I remember the experience. It's like it's burned into my memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a lot of happy things I can't remember as well. But like, I think I think your brains naturally do have like a negativity bias, I think, in these things. And like, when you see it as a negative experience, like
it's like a defense mechanism, right? Like you try to protect yourself from these things happening again, which is not always healthy.
But for me, I kind of think it was a huge driver, because it's like, you know, I really can't stand rejection. I was like, well, I'm going to, like, you know, fuck everyone else. I'm just going to start my own business, you know? And not only that, but I was going to try to set it up in a way that would shield me from kind of further rejection.
Yeah.
So I think, while I kind of think there's, you know, so in terms of like, in terms of the certain things that I do for kind of Jackie Winter, a lot of my drive for success can also be seen as a drive not to be kind of rejected.
Yeah.
So I think while that has a good...
Oh, I love our therapy sessions.
They're really good. But, you know, you could say that it has a net positive result in kind of some ways, that a business has kind of resulted from that. But like, at the same time, it's been really hard for me as a manager, because like, I feel like, well, I've tried to kind of walk away from the more kind of painful areas and like, you know, and offload them to you guys, and you're so much better at being rejected. But also...
Yeah, but that's like, you hire people who do the bits that you can't or don't want.
Well, here's the most interesting bit in terms of rejecting job candidates as well, because we're actually in the middle of that process. And I kind of think to be the person who has to do that kind of rejection is really very, very kind of hard as well. And again, like, how do you kind of, like, you know, what are those conversations like, and how do you kind of frame those things? Because there have been people here, for example, like, I mean, Mel, you know, who's been here for many years, she applied for a different role, was rejected for that role, and then eventually kind of gotten here in another way. So
thank God she did.
Exactly.
Because the office would not survive without her.
But you could also say that was a result of our kind of process in terms of how we reject people. You know, like, I think it's really important for me. It's like, I don't want to get kind of too focused on kind of the job thing, but I think the idea of rejection like needs to or could potentially kind of be reframed. And so it's like, for in the job process, I make sure it's like, okay, well, we need to make sure we're putting in enough effort to have a great job description, a great process, so we're only attracting people that are kind of relevant there. And then I have another kind of thing where it's like, well, everyone is responded to, you know, and everyone is kind of heard. And I kind of think having that kind of blanket rejection, which is like, you know, you say as like kind of a writer, happens all the time. And The New Yorker almost has kind of turned it into a bit of a parody in terms of the letter, you know, you get those like kind of little slips back, and some people, like, you know, writers always say, here's my rejection slip. It's kind of that kind of badge of honor. But I've tried to kind of, like, you know, we have to reject people all the time. There are people that kind of email us for artist submissions, you know, and that's kind of something that I initially kind of said, like, okay, I was going to respond to everybody, but I kind of don't.
It's not feasible. Yeah. There's so many.
It's not feasible, but, you know, there's, you know, that could leave some kind of lingering kind of resentment kind of over there.
Yeah,
but
so how do you do it without,
Yeah.
I think, the whole link between pain and rejection is so interesting. I think neuroscientists just have by far the most interesting jobs.
Fascinating jobs.
I so wish I could have gone down that path. But I think the fact that the brain's response to rejection is similar to that of physical pain is like fascinating, but not surprising to anyone who's actually felt rejected before, you know?
Absolutely.
Because it can actually be physically painful. Like it can manifest physically in ways that really show that, like tears and tummy aches and you know, exhaustion or whatever. And like, oh God, it's like, it's so hard because it's like sometimes rejection actually should discourage you from something. Like
it should.
Yeah. And then other times it should definitely not discourage you from everything and not trying anything new ever again. And rejection can often then be like people project about previous rejections on new opportunities. And it's like, it becomes a whole mess. And like, it's why we all go to therapy and, you know, like.
But I think you can also learn from it. And I think pain is also information. Yes. And when something hurts in a certain way, you can then reframe it and think about, you know, how can you use that as a tool?
Yes.
And how can you use it kind of like to build resilience and to
completely
come out, you know, you don't learn. I feel like I've learned way more from the things that I failed at than from the things that I've been really successful at.
Completely. Yeah. You were mentioning earlier, we were chatting about this. There was about the kind of transparencies of like highs and lows of creative businesses.
Yes.
And we talk a lot about transparency on this podcast because it's just something you're particularly interested in, Jeremy, all of us, and how companies or individuals can be more transparent about their failures.
Yes, absolutely.
And we are kind of, I think we are starting to see more of this. Do you think?
I think we are. Particularly in the writing world, we're starting to see more of this, which I think is really, really, really important. I just think it's just important to not present this kind of glossy version of success. And I think it's like Instagram hashtag hustle culture has had a lot to answer for in terms of this.
And hugely.
I think it's really glamorized working for yourself in a way that I think is not always realistic. You know, it's not just the fancy co-working space. It's not just the, you know.
I mean, Jeremy's pretty glamorous. No, I mean, we were talking recently on the show about the guy who started Gumroad, and he wrote this big post about
Bloody Gumroad.
He wrote this big post about his sort of quote unquote failure with the company. And obviously, anyone who knows anything about Gumroad, it's not a failure, but he turned around and I thought it was a good piece. But I think definitely there's this idea we talked about then, like a lot of people do actually talk about failure and hardship, but only once they've kind of redeemed themselves and become successful again. But again, like, you know, talking about failure when you haven't bounced back from it is
harder,
understandably less common.
Yeah,
like someone in the throes of that probably isn't thinking about shouting it from the rooftops.
No.
My life is fucked.
It's, like, it's not part of the narrative, you know?
No,
and
exactly.
I'm really interested in narratives now that aren't just about these crazy success trajectories. It's just about how do you kind of integrate failure into your life and how do you kind of come to terms with that kind of doubt? And how can it can be like, how can it be a good, and it's like that thing with productivity as well, you know, where sort of like, you know, people talk about, I know for me, the times I've got rejected in the past and, you know, I remember losing a job and that kind of made me want to become a full-time freelancer. And that gave me that kind of fuel, similar to your lounge getting rejected from sponsored lounge experience. I've been fired for like muffin break when I was young, which I sometimes laugh about.
It's fine. I got fired from General Pants. So it's all the same.
Did you really?
Yeah, let go.
Oh man, I would love to hear more of these stories. Well, look, yeah, a lot of really interesting things to think about in a short piece. And yeah, this whole Smarter Living section from the Times has been fantastic. Another reason to support quality journalism.
Yes, you know, can I add one very small thought?
Can I reject you?
No.
Okay.
I just want to say, just really on that last bit, like one thing that I wish it was possible to hear more about is the highs and lows of creative relationships.
Yes.
Like for obvious reasons, I think people are super reluctant to open up about the specifics of working together, whether it's like client and supplier, two colleagues, publisher, advertiser, whatever. Yeah. And we talk about it in general terms, but specific detailed stories about the ins and outs of a creative relationship and what goes wrong and why are like very, very, very rare. And I'd love to hear more of this if you could somehow convince people that it wouldn't ruin their reputations, even though it probably would. But yeah, that's all.
New podcast idea right there.
Yep.
Awesome, Nia. Thank you so much for bringing this up and we'll wrap up from here. Before we go, though, it's time for the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the completely breathtaking off of our chest. Laura, what do you got for us this week? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka?
I'm doing a thumbs up for the Emerald Village Bakery that you told me I would forget at the start of the show, and I didn't. I went to near your neck of the woods, Jeremy, on the weekend for Easter, and we went to Emerald because it was nearby, has a cool name, whatever, and there was nothing open because it was Easter, and we just saw this like very, I don't know, unassuming bakery or like whatever. I guess we'll go here and have like a shitty pie or something. And we had the dog. So I stayed outside. Dan went in, my partner, and he comes back out and he's like, you're going to be in there a while. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, just trust me. He's like, you're going to flip out. And I was like, what? All right. I go in and there's just like food everywhere.
Sounds incredible.
Like just incredible pastries.
Cornucopia.
It's, oh my God. It's, I think, what heaven looks like.
Oh, wow.
I reckon when you die, if you've been good, you're then surrounded by like arancini balls and like lasagnas.
Amazing.
It was awesome. And they do this like meal prep thing. And they've got this like, so they've got all their pastries and the hot cross buns and the blah, blah, blah. But then they've got this big fridge of like meal prep, and it's like $50 for 5 Tupperwares of like yummy salads and pastas and whatever. And I just bought all my food for the week, and I've done no cooking all week, and it's so fucking good. Jeremy, please tell me you agree with me for once. Oh my God, what is wrong with you?
It's one of those things where it's like, you know, too much of a good thing. No matter how good something is, when you get it enough, it like, you know, the effect kind of lessens on you.
But there's so much variety. Like,
I need to get there.
It's so good. I sent my dad there yesterday. And Jeremy, I'm going to need you to start doing like meal prep runs for me, because it's too far for me to go every week, but it's really near you. So if you could start just like bringing me a big thing of groceries each week from there, that would be great.
I'll see. Neha, what about you this week?
I've got a thumbs up.
Nice.
Another article that I read in The Atlantic called The End of Instagram Aesthetic.
I have this open.
I haven't read it.
No, it's one of my 7,000 open tabs.
On the same wavelength.
Yes.
But I was overjoyed because at the end, apparently, of Instagram Aesthetic, which is the end of millennial pink, the end of...
We have discussed this before, and I don't know if it is, but we'll see.
The end of avocado toast. And it's kind of essentially talks about, ties into what we were talking about before, how that kind of glamour of the life you present on Instagram is no longer engaging people on Instagram, apparently. And so we've apparently hit saturation point.
Mm-hmm.
Which is excellent.
Sort of, there was another one that came out recently about flooding the culture with sameness.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That same content. Yeah.
Well, algorithms that, you know, the algorithm just kind of standardizing this aesthetic. So everyone
is inevitable.
Looks
we were going to bounce back from that at some point.
Yeah.
Hit the wall and reverb. And we'll go into something just as annoying, I imagine.
Exactly. But it's just, it's a relief because it's kind of like, hang on a sec.
And something new. Yeah.
Something new. And people are trying to be more transparent on Instagram and make their lives look real, which, you know, let's hope so.
Yeah. Jeremy, what you got?
My thumbs up for the week. Actually, it's
going
to be a shocker.
We're so positive.
No, I'm going shocker because this is really awesome.
And it won't fit in the newsletter if we have three thumbs
up. Exactly. That's my real reason. But yeah, no, it's just for binoculars. Like, I did speak about this in my newsletter intro the other
banal
week.
Things for this segment.
No, have you ever, like, well, this is for good binoculars, in particular, image stabilization binoculars, which is kind of like basically you hit a button and then, like, I don't know, like if you use really good binoculars and you're far away, like, you know, small movements are actually, you know, magnified, so it gets really shaky. But, Canon has kind of the best image stabilizing technology. You hit the button and just like stays completely still without a tripod, so you can kind of move it around. And like, you know, when you listen, like when you've heard great music on great headphones, and it, just like the difference, like like binoculars like that for your eyes, like, you know, you think you see things kind of normally, but like it actually kind of like when you put binoculars on it, it just enhances vision so much. Like, I think it's just
are these
wild.
The ones you have at Jackie Winter Gardens?
No, these are this is my personal stash. So
your personal stash of binoculars.
Exactly.
Well, we're buying binoculars for our new van, so we can like look at cool birds and shit. So you'll have to tell us which ones.
I will. Neha, before we go for the week, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
Online?
Yes.
Just at my website, which is www.nehakale.com. And I'm on Twitter. I try not to be on Twitter when I'm on deadline too much, but I'm on Twitter and on Instagram.
Nice.
Love the surname, by the way. Like any,
Kale looked on trend.
Very on trend.
Very on trend.
I bet you
what
are
can I say?
So sick of that joke.
Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
That was awesome.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. And if you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And to receive all the links we talk about in the show each week in one little package, you can sign up to our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter, that's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, or any number of supported players, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you very much for listening. We will catch you next week, and bye-bye.
had the arancini salad from the Emerald Village Bakery, Jeremy, my new favorite place in the world.
Oh, yeah, no, we got to talk more about that.
Amazing. That's my thumbs up.
Okay. Write that down. You'll forget.
It's in my head. I won't forget. All I can taste is garlic.
You'll forget.
I won't forget.